position, whatever government takes necessary measures
in order to correct
the economic situation, they will need a consensus. They will pay a political price. And if you don't have a consensus, it will be politically infeasible for the government to carry out these measures, these difficult economic measures, as a way out of the crisis.
We have to leave it there. Steve Ellner, former professor and associate managing editor of the journal Latin American Perspectives. Thank you to Alejandro Velasco and Medea Benjamin. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock. Coming up next on Positively Revolting, Ani discusses the immigration experience with Mary Ruth Petzing.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Voice, an evening on Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church in Portland. The One Voice event features a film screening of Unaccompanied, Alone in America, a documentary about immigrant children who have been separated from their parents while seeking refuge in the U.S., as well as performances by Jennifer Berezin and Chris Webster. This is a benefit for Immigration Counseling Service, Oregon's oldest nonprofit immigration law firm. Again, that's One Voice, Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church, 4525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, women-owned since 1981, providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting, and I am your host, Ani. Now that that's all out of the way, we turn our attention this morning to the topics at hand. This morning, we are looking at immigration and the experience of immigrants. We are joined in the studio with Mari Ruth Petzing, who is from Immigration Counseling Services Law Office.
That's right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so very much for being here this morning, Mari Ruth. We have, on Positively Revolting, over the last several years, looked at immigration and looked at the experience of immigrants from the ICE raids that we saw under Obama, that it's certainly from the rhetoric and increased actions of the Trump administration, and certainly over this last year, as things have been spiraling in a pretty vigorous way, with rhetoric that paints immigrants in such, well, it dehumanizes them and uses such hate speech, really, frankly, to characterize people seeking to come to the U.S. to live, to work, to be. And I thought that we would start with, actually, I haven't often had somebody who is from the law profession. I've often had community organizers or immigrants themselves speaking about their experiences. So I'm really wanting to take advantage of your experience this morning to help define terms and to help bring some basic education and knowledge, drop some knowledge in the community.
Excellent.
So let's start off sort of at the very top. We use, we hear in mainstream media and oftentimes mistakenly use these terms kind of interchangeably, the terms refugee, immigrant, and asylum seeker. Let's start off with just breaking those down. What is, who is a refugee?
Okay, well, that's a great question because there's legal definitions of each of these terms, and then there's how they're used in everyday life. So I'm going to start with kind of the legalese. So a refugee is somebody who has been found to have refugee status by a refugee status determining body, which is just fancy words for somebody empowered to make a determination. And in kind of the Western world, in the United States, in Canada, in the UK, in Australia, in France, that's the government of the country. But in a lot of the world where most of the world's refugees are located, it's actually usually the UNHCR, High Commission for Refugees. And a refugee is defined as someone who is outside of their country of origin or last residence, who is unable or unwilling to return to their own country because of a well-founded fear of persecution based on one of five grounds. And those grounds are race, religion, social group, a particular social group, ethnicity or national origin, right, and political opinion. And so usually when we say a refugee in the United States, when we say somebody who's come to the United States as a refugee, what that means is that they actually fled their country and were in a second country. For example, a Somali refugee may flee to Kenya. A Syrian refugee may flee to Turkey. And they actually register as refugees with the UN High Commission for Refugees in that other country. And then apply for resettlement to a third country.
Okay.
And so they actually come to the U.S. already having gone through all of the process, which is a years-long process of first going through the U.N. and then going through the U.S. And the U.N. refers people to Canada or Australia or different countries. One thing that's happened under the Trump administration is that the U.S. has drastically reduced the number of refugees that we accept every year to the lowest level ever since the program began. That's contrasted with asylum seekers. These are people who are applying to be considered refugees. And so they come to the U.S. and nobody has ever looked at their claim for refugee status before they set foot on U.S. soil. And so these people are generally presenting themselves at the southern border or at airports or, in fact, at the northern border sometimes and saying, I want to claim that I am a refugee. And so I am claiming asylum. And so the U.S. government is looking at their claim for the first time.
The reasoning, mm-hmm. though, would be similar to the refugee, right? So, but the difference then is whether you are actually claiming that status here at the U.S. borders, or if you've had a second country to intervene.
Right. It's basically if you're applying, it's the same law, the mm-hmm. same. It's actually a convention then, which is a treaty, just a word for a treaty that the U.S. And basically every other country in the world has signed and ratified. It's the same treaty, but if you're an asylum seeker, you're actually applying for protection under that law and under that treaty here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And if you're a refugee, you already did that.
Right.
You were already processed by a third country or by the UNHCR and also by the United States. A process usually takes about 2 years before you even come to the country.
Right. And then we have immigrant.
So in the law, an immigrant is actually somebody who has a green card, somebody who's a lawful permanent resident. That's a very specific definition of immigrant. Typically in the United States, people use the word immigrant to mean anybody who is from another country and here in the United States on some sort of long-term or permanent plan, whether or not that actually happens. But legally, immigrants are people who already have a green card or lawful permanent residency status.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, refugees and asylees under U.S. law are actually considered not immigrants.
Okay.
But in real day-to-day life, people refer to themselves and to, you know, members of their community as immigrants as well.
Right. It, sort of going to the common usage of was born in a different country, now I live here.
Basically.
Right. So we have this, you know, we people come and people migrate and people move around the world for various reasons. Could mm-hmm. be economic opportunity, could be family status and love and all of these things. Could be persecution.
Right.
Could be the fact that your country has been democratized or colonized, depending how you want to look at that, and that there are your country's been utterly broken and corrupted by imperialist forces, through trade acts. Could be like that. Could be any of a number of reasons that people are seeking a life outside their country of origin. Mm-hmm. But now we're in this state in 2019 U.S. History where the rhetoric mm-hmm. is so deafening at this point mm-hmm. that it is so hate-filled. And at issue, at heart right now, we are looking at the longest shutdown the country's ever had. Why? Because the president is throwing a temper tantrum over building a wall and probably trying to break the government and distract from his imminent persecutions. Stuff like that could also be happening. But what we're hearing are about the dangerous folks, mm-hmm. caravans of terrorists and rapists and murderers
mm-hmm.
Coming to get us. And that's why we need 5.7 billion dollars now for a monument to hate, basically, and stupidity, called the wall on the southern border. So I guess this is, for me, a really timely time to break it down and to mm-hmm. say, what are we talking about when we look at the experience of people who are really coming to this country to make a better life or mm-hmm. to continue their life,
mm-hmm.
Which would be endangered in their country of origin.
Okay.
To know that we are in a country that, with the exception of Native people, First Nations people, Indigenous folks who were here first before there were borders, and folks that were brought against their will in slave trades and indentured servitudes, that all the rest of us are immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to hear all this rhetoric at this point, not only is disheartening in a way that really shows our tendency towards racism, towards dehumanizing the other, but also really disheartening in our sense of ahistoricism. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to turn there and look at currently what happens. We know there have been issues with ICE, with detention centers. Mm-hmm. How many, if looking at the last year with the horrific policies of this administration, separating families at borders, I want to just sort of look for a moment and do a little snapshot of what's happening in detention centers. Mm-hmm. When people are present, when people come to the country without documentation, mm-hmm. There's ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement.
Well, usually if somebody's arriving in the country, it's going to be CBP, which is Customs and Border Protection,
right.
and that initially arrests them. But so Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement are both part of the Department of Homeland Security, and they are both forms of immigration police.
Right. And so I know the ICE detention centers have gotten a lot of attention, and mm-hmm. deservedly so, because the experience, from what I understand, is pretty horrific. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody is detained by ICE, oftentimes the ICE detention centers are private, for-profit detention centers mm-hmm. that are contracted by the government. Is that true?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So, sure. So when somebody is detained, they're sent to either a actual ICE detention facility, but those are very few and far between. So usually they're sent to a for-profit run by Geo Group or CoreCivic, or they're sent to a public facility that has a contract with ICE. And so that can be a local jail or a federal prison, or even a state facility. And those are paid by ICE. And so they're effectively running public for-profit detention centers. So it's kind of you get a private for-profit detention center or a public for-profit detention center. The children are usually turned over to ORR custody. That's the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And they're actually usually placed in nonprofit detention centers, so run by nonprofit organizations. There are a few children who are in ICE custody that are not given to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and they are in public juvenile facilities with ICE contracts. There's only a couple of them in the country, but we have one in Oregon and one in Longview, Washington.
Hey, who is that in Oregon?
NORCOR, Northern Oregon Regional Correctional Facility, which is located in the Dalles.
Right. I want to actually invite our listeners to call on in with your questions and your comments this morning. This is Positively Revolting. You're listening to KABU, your community radio station. I'm Ani, and my guest this morning is Mari Ruth Petsing from Immigration Counseling Services Law Office. And your number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. So there are a few different, in the Northwest, there are a few different detention facilities. We know that when people are being detained in Tacoma is a large detention facility. They are often brought through downtown Portland at the GeoForce McAdam building for a few hours before being transferred to Tacoma or to NORCOR in the Dalles. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how the detention centers work together? What is the shuffling around of people about? Mm-hmm. How does that all work?
Yeah, so one of the things about immigration is that because it's national, they can actually move people without warning, without notice, anywhere in the country, mm-hmm. Which is incredibly disruptive, both to people's family connections and to legal representation. you know, speaking
oh, right.
as a lawyer, it's quite obnoxious when you go to meet with your client and your client is now in another state and nobody bothered to tell you about it. So
not to mention what your client might be feeling at that point. My goodness, I hadn't, you know, I always think about the family connection, but I hadn't thought about what that does to your representation with counsel.
It's very disruptive.
Yeah.
And then it's also obviously extremely disruptive because you switch courts and so you have to get rescheduled. And so this can delay cases. It's extremely difficult for people because they not only do they lose their family connections often, but people have been detained with the same other people for months and months and months and have started to create friendships or relationships.
Yeah, right.
And then all of that is broken as well. So people can be shuffled around anywhere. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we don't see that very often. We get people usually transferred to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. That's right now it's a 1,575-bed facility, which is run by GEO Group, which is a for-profit private prison company. And usually people who are arrested within the Pacific Northwest are taken there first, although not always. But that's kind of their main facility and their default placement. Mm-hmm. Also, people are transferred from elsewhere, typically from the border. So we'll get people who are transferred from Texas or Arizona up to the Tacoma Detention Center. From there, people will often be sent to the two main facilities that they use in the Pacific Northwest are the NorCor facility in the Dalles and the Yakima County Jail in Yakima, Washington. And what we see is we see people transferred to those facilities in kind of a couple of circumstances. One is if they're kind of a headache or a problem, we see that they get kind of shifted out. And two, if they're going to be often longer term, obviously, if people are, if they think they're going to be putting them on a plane, all of their flights go out of the SeaTac
right.
area. So that's where they keep people. If they assume that they're going to have this person in prison, in detention for 6 months, 8 months, a year, 2 years, they'll sometimes look to stick them in the jails. But then they transfer them back and forth every time they have a hearing, every time they want a medical something, every time they need to get a paper notarized, and every time that they just feel like the numbers work to switch them around. And so people come and go many times back and forth between facilities.
I want to point out something. A lot of times, you know, to preserve mental health, never read the comments, right? This is advice I've heard. And yet I go right there and I read the comments. And I am always astonished by how many people seem to think that folks that are here without papers, without proper legal documentation, mm-hmm. have committed a felony,
mm-hmm.
are criminals by mm-hmm. their very nature, otherwise they would have the papers signed mm-hmm. by the right person.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about criminal status and immigration?
Yeah, I definitely can. So first of all, I'd like to just start with the idea that there are people who are not criminals. I mean, obviously infants probably. But I have yet to meet an adult person who is not a criminal. I certainly am a criminal. And every person that I know, every person that I love is also a criminal. And to the extent that people do not have criminal records, that's usually due to a combination of luck and privilege.
Absolutely.
So I just want to encourage people to think about all the times that they may have eaten a special brownie before it was particularly legal, or drank some alcohol before they were allowed, or been a good big sibling and provided some to their younger siblings, or driven when they perhaps should not have been driving, or shoplifted you know, a candy bar or a dare
sure.
or something like that, or in fact committed all sorts of other things. Like my favorite that I have certainly done in my life is sign something under penalty of perjury saying I read it
oh, yeah.
when I did not in fact read it.
Always good. You live on the edge, Mari Ruth.
As a lawyer, I'm particularly proud of having done that multiple times. But the point is, there's actually a lot of crimes that we all commit regularly. And so I just want to encourage people to think about themselves when they hear the word criminal and their own actions. And
recognize ourselves in that group.
And think of that, if that really could be us.
Mm-hmm.
But second of all...
And you made my board operator laugh. So that's always good.
I hope they see themselves in that.
I think that's why we're laughing. Yes.
But second of all, so there's a number of ways to be undocumented in the United States. And some of them involve something that is a crime under the code of the United States code. And some of them do not. Some of them are simply civil violations. There are immigration-related felonies, but the majority of people that I actually see on a daily basis have not committed one of those. So most of the people who are in immigration detention either have not committed a crime related to their immigration status or have committed at most a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's very important to understand is that showing up and requesting asylum is not a crime. And so all of these families who are waiting weeks and weeks and weeks and trying to ask for asylum at the U.S. border, that's not a crime in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But U.S. law still puts them in prison for that non-crime. And it's actually civil detention for the administrative convenience, that's a quote, of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So they are not locked up for being criminals. They're locked up because it makes it easier for us to dehumanize and deport them.
And it's actually following the damn process.
Exactly.
Right? You're supposed to, if you are seeking asylum, you are supposed to show up at an office and say, this is why I'm seeking asylum. This is why I feel my life is threatened. This is why I'm here now.
That's exactly what you're supposed to do. And it's important to note that you actually cannot, except for under a very specific and very unusual set of circumstances, seek asylum outside the United States. So if your life is threatened in your country, the legal option open to you is to show up at the United States border.
Right.
There is no way to call the United States and say, I am a gay man and that's illegal in my country and I have been beaten and raped and threatened and put in prison and I want to live somewhere where I can be safe. Can you just send me over some paperwork? That doesn't exist.
Right.
You have to get here and then ask.
That is, again, sobering. It's a reality that is lost on so many people who are living in the U.S. Who, again, just show a complete ignorance for the process and then vilify the people who are trying to use the process to save their lives. I find that maddening, frankly. I don't have any other words for it this morning. I want to invite our listeners to join us. 503-231-8187 is the number to call this morning. Please do join in our conversation. 503-231-8187. I am here with Mari Ruth Petzing. She is from Immigration Counseling Services. And we have so much to talk about and only a half hour left to do it. I want to also remind folks that at 9 o'clock this morning, you can listen to One Land, Many Voices here on KBOO. Today, they will be airing remarks delivered at the Realities of Jerusalem Today conference. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views gives a window into life as a campaign manager for a local grassroots bid. At 10:15, you'll hear Dennis Bernstein with Flashpoints. And at 11, Pacific Underground will have Jake and Sarah joining a Korean-Canadian poet, Emily Youngmin Yoon, to talk about her debut full-length poetry collection. All of these programs are made possible by your support. Dear KBOO members, if you are not yet a KBOO member, you can take care of that embarrassing problem right now. Just go to kboo.fm and click donate so that you too can be supporting independent thought and independent programs and community radio, just like you're listening to right now. I'm Ani, and this is Positively Revolting. 503 231-8187 is the number to call this morning to join us. Ray, our board operator, asks a question because he can type it to me quickly and quietly. He asks if other countries actually have the same sort of detaining or incarceration process for asylum seekers.
That's a really good question. Some do. Australia is somewhat infamous that they have prison islands for asylum seekers. They obviously, because of their geography, people who arrive seeking asylum in Australia who are not already refugees arrive by boat in large numbers, those who can't afford a plane ticket and somehow to get a visa. And so they actually just stick them on these prison islands. A lot of countries have some detention depending on a number of circumstances, and a lot of countries have restricted motion. So, for example, Germany will often restrict people to a city or an area. And so people are free to move about. They're not in locked doors, but they're not permitted to, for example, move from Munich to Berlin.
Right.
And so there's different kind of levels of restriction. Some countries attempt to keep people in refugee camps. And others actually have no restrictions at all on your movement within the country once you arrive and register that you're seeking asylum.
So there's a wide variety.
So there's a wide range.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Let's go ahead and take a couple of folks who have been listening. Sutri. Good morning, Sutri. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having this conversation. And I missed the very first part of it, but I just wondered how families of immigrants are able to keep in touch with people who have been taken.
That's a great question.
Thank you, Sutri, for that question. It's a big challenge. You can't call your family member. Your family member can only call you, and it's expensive depending on where somebody's held. At the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, it's actually relatively cheaper, maybe about 7 cents a minute. For example, at the Norcourt Jail in the Dalles, it's 25 cents a minute. And for people who have no income, or people who work at the detention center in Tacoma make $1 a day, not an hour, a day. So that goes fast.
Yeah. That's a 10-minute phone call.
That's it's very hard to keep in touch. There's at the Tacoma Detention Center, you can visit through glass. For example, at NorCor, you can't visit in person at all, not through glass, nothing. So you're restricted to basically using these jail tell systems that provide kind of a Skype experience if you can A, afford it, and B, know how to use it, or occasional phone calls.
Wow. And I want to sort of unpack for a moment the whole dollar a day. So these are for-profit detention centers.
That's right.
And the detainees have an option.
Yes.
And I'm using scare quotes in the option. They don't come across well on radio, but I've heard differing things about how optional it is to work in these for-profit detention centers for a dollar a day.
That's right.
So that you can buy things that are actually the necessities of life at the concessionaries, like soap and, you know, things.
Yes. Food.
For example.
For example. Yes. So all of the ICE detention facilities, in the for-profit detention facilities in the country, offer a quote option, and people do have different stories about how optional that is, to work for $1 a day. And that is actually set by law. But that is being challenged because, as you might notice, it's significantly under minimum wage.
Significantly.
By a lot.
Significantly a lot.
Significantly a lot under minimum wage. And so, and the centers work, run on that work. the detainees
clean. Right, these are essential
clean.
Services,
they
right?
They clean the center, they cook the food, they do the laundry, they all of the things
take
that
care of the grounds.
They take care, I mean, all yeah. of the things that the center needs to run
yeah.
Is mostly done by detainees working for $1 a day. And the for-profit company then is able to profit off of that labor.
And sell commodities at inflated prices like you're at a freaking airport. So, you know, again, this is just sort of a coming and going situation, right? And the inhumanity of it is absolutely staggering. Let's go ahead and talk to Dennis. Good morning, Dennis. You are on the air. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You too can join us like Dennis has. Good morning, Dennis. You are on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I've heard, I believe in connection with what you're talking about, I may be wrong, about this so-called Flores Agreement. What can you explain what that is?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis. That is a great question. So the Flores Agreement was a result of a lawsuit that was brought many years ago about the treatment of children in immigration detention. And before this agreement, children were basically universally locked in jails and often even adult prisons. And so this agreement is actually a settlement, meaning it's an out-of-court agreement, but supervised by a court. And it says that children basically, in broad terms, must be housed in the least restrictive environment possible. And so that's how this process of when children are detained, they're turned over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and then placed in these nonprofit run facilities, and there's various levels of security. So some of them are staff secure, meaning that they are locked, and others are not. Some are shelters that children come and go during the day. They may attend a local school. So we have in Oregon, we have two non-secure and one staff secure facility. Washington has two shelter and two staff secure facilities. And so children are usually placed in those facilities. The agreement covers both children who are not with a family member, who mm-hmm. are unaccompanied, and children with family members. And so the Flores settlement is the reason that you see some families released into the U.S. with sometimes the adult on like an ankle monitor and the children released, because the government is prohibited from keeping children in prison settings if there's a less restrictive method possible.
So bring that forward to what we saw last May, June, July, and on with the detention of juveniles.
Yeah. So I do want to highlight, this is not something that just started. This is something that had existed actually for many, many years, but then was slowly being kind of ramped up. And so what happens in this case, in these separation cases, is that the family unit is separated, the adult is placed in detention, and the child is sent to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and then placed, and they may be placed in foster care or in a shelter facility, really anywhere in the United States. And there's no process wherein the relationship between the adult and the child is tracked. And there's no real attempt or intent that they will be reunited. And there's also no review, no judicial review of that decision to separate the family. So at this point right now, the government's position is they only separate for the safety and well-being of the child, which had been the standard before, but for some reason that nobody can quite figure out, the percentage, the number of separations, not just the gross number, but the percentage of separations has tripled, quadrupled, quintupled. Nobody knows exactly for sure how much, right, but by a lot. And they don't have to justify why they believe this child to be, quote, in danger. If the government wants to take your child here in the U.S. into foster care, for example, mm-hmm. they have to go to court and they have to tell a judge why your child is not safe in your home.
Mm-hmm.
But at the border, an officer just decides, well, I think maybe we have a suspicion that you might be a criminal, so I'm just going to take your kid.
Right. Or what I have read in the comments section, mm-hmm. any parent that drags their kid across the desert is putting them in danger and therefore is not fit to parent.
Yes.
And that mentality.
That mentality, does exist. Why would you take your child on a dangerous and perilous journey? And typically the reason is because it's more dangerous and more perilous to leave them behind.
Right. And that is a reality that just seems to be lost on people so much over and over.
I did want to bring up, though, because Dennis brought mm-hmm. up the Flores settlement, which is a really important point, is that the Trump administration is actively fighting against the Flores settlement and seeking ways to basically overturn the settlement with new regulations that will allow them to detain children and families effectively indefinitely.
Okay. Damn. You know, it's just like the hits just keep coming. So we saw there was an immediate order to try to return and reunite families.
Mm-hmm.
That was a case brought by the ACLU over the summer. And then we heard that, well, maybe there weren't actually records kept that are allowing this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
The difficulties involved in trying to reunite.
So what happens is that when a child is separated, they get shuffled into ORR custody, and there's no actual notation that even they have been separated. They're listed as unaccompanied, and they're sent wherever they're sent, and whoever receives them, whether that's a foster facility, a foster care family, or a shelter, or a staff secure facility, the paperwork does not indicate that that child was actually separated.
Mm.
And so the only real way that people find out is by talking to the children or by talking to the parents. And since people in immigration detention aren't automatically afforded a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
The parent doesn't necessarily have a lawyer to say, hey, my child, what happened to my child? And the child doesn't necessarily have a lawyer to say, hey, where's the parent?
And the child could be one.
And the child also could be nonverbal.
Yeah.
So that makes it very challenging. And really, most of the cases that have been successfully reunited has been a huge effort by attorneys, nonprofit organizations, community organizations to basically connect these families back together through often cold calling 50 facilities to try and find where these families have been taken. Because the paperwork there's no system or structure in place to indicate this child came with this person, this is this person's full name, date of birth,
mm-hmm.
File number, etc. It's just really up to people to make the connection on their own.
Right. And that is just a nightmare. As a lawyer that's working within this community,
mm-hmm.
what does it do to you when you see a picture of a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old taking a stand in an immigrant court setting without, what does that do to you?
Well, sometimes it's just, I will say, we don't typically see that. That's an unusual circumstance. The youngest child I've gone to court with without a parent was 2. So it does happen. But most of the people we see, and in fact, because we don't have any, quote, tender age shelters here,
mm-hmm.
The kids that we see are usually 12 and up.
Mm-hmm.
Although some children who've been sent to foster care here or reunited with a family member here are younger. But I think the very little kids actually are, it's generally less of a concern because, it's deeply concerning. but
all at the same time,
I
understand how that goes.
But the very little children often, don't really understand what's going on at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had, the joy of asking children, right, like, what country are you from? And they don't know what a country is,
right.
you know.
Right.
What's really, I find most impactful is when you're sitting next to a child who's maybe 14 and knows enough to understand that this person basically has this judge that they're sitting in front of, you know, basically controls what happens to their life, and that they themselves have often chosen to flee because they have been threatened, they have been shot, they mm-hmm. have been raped, mm-hmm. they have, and they're facing being returned to that, and they know it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're expected to advocate for themselves before this judge sitting above them in a robe and against a lawyer
mm-hmm.
in a place that they do not know mm. how it works. They don't speak the language, and they know what's at stake. Mm. And that's just terrifying.
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine that feeling. I can't imagine it as an adult.
Right.
And, you know, these, you know, they are children.
Yeah.
And they're trying so hard.
Yeah.
To do this incredible effort and work that any adult would find extremely difficult, both just intellectually and emotionally. And you know, and they're trying not to cry in court, right?
Right.
And that, I mean, that is just it's both humbling and heartbreaking.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and take a call. And Kim is next. Good morning, Kim. You're on the air.
Thank you. You had indicated that an immigrant is a lawful permanent resident who has a green card. I had heard that most violations are for overstaying a green card. And I was wondering, for how long are green cards issued? And if you overstay, is that a civil or a criminal infraction?
Thank you. That's a great question. So I'll clear up a couple things. So most people now in the U.S. who are newly undocumented in the United States have not crossed the border illegally, but rather have come in with a visa and then overstayed. But those are actually what are called non-immigrant visas. And they're called non-immigrant visas because they are not permanent. They do expire.
Like if you were touristing.
If you are a tourist or a student mm-hmm. or a temporary worker or any number mm-hmm. of, there's, we call it alphabet soup because it starts at A and goes all the way through T, U, V, mm-hmm. W. And so when people come to the U.S. on a visa, they may be valid for different lengths of time, anywhere from a couple of weeks or months to years, but they have a finite end date. The lawful permanent resident status is permanent. It never expires. The actual physical green card is good for 10 years and then it expires, but you can't be deported because your green card expires. Your status is still the same. It's just the physical card expires. So I tell people, it's like if you have a U.S. passport, your passport may expire and you can't use it to travel, but you're still a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a green card, if your green card expires, you can't use it, but you're still a permanent resident and you can still get a new card.
Excellent. Let's, you know, we have an event.
Oh, and sorry, there was a second part to that question. I didn't want to skip it. Overstaying a visa is a civil infraction, okay. Not a criminal infraction.
Thanks very much for clearing that up too. I want to, we would be amiss if we did not talk about this event that is coming up on the 1st of February. It is a benefit, actually, for the Immigrant Counseling Services, yes?
Yes. So,
can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit. We're an independent nonprofit, so that means that we're not part of any larger group. We're 40-plus years old. We're the oldest immigration legal services nonprofit here in the state. And we have been just really lucky that these two actually wonderful women, singer, songwriter, just musical geniuses, have agreed to put on a concert, which is on Friday, February 1st at 7 o'clock at the Unity Church on Southeast Stark. Tickets available online.
And that's 1 week from today.
That's 1 week from today. And all the proceeds are going to go to support our services. We provide immigration legal services, meaning representation in immigration court and before the different immigration agencies to people around the state of Oregon and in Southwest Washington. We are a, as I said, we are a nonprofit, and so our fees are low. They are actually not, don't cover the cost of us providing representation. So we're only able to represent people because of the kind contributions from the larger community that help us to provide lawyers to people facing deportation or seeking to get immigration status in the United States. We work, we have a special project working with unaccompanied immigrant children here in Oregon. And we also actually have a project working with survivors of trafficking.
Excellent. And I see that there's a special screening of Unaccompanied, Alone in America, that will happen prior to the musical performance. And that is all next Friday night at 7 o'clock, as Mari Ruth was just saying, at Unity of Portland, 4525 Southeast Stark.
Yes. And it's a short film, but very impactful. So if I encourage people to see it, go to the event. If you can't make the event, at least look it up online and watch it.
And remember the Immigration Counseling Services and their work while you're watching it, if you can't make it to the benefit. I'll just leave it there. Let's talk to Karen. Karen, I think you're probably going to be the last caller of the morning as we are nearly out of time.
Right. Well, good morning, Ani and Mari Ruth. It's wonderful to hear you. Hear Mari Ruth on the radio because I've heard her speak before and she is brilliant. And
thank you, Karen.
Wanted hi, Mari Ruth. I just wanted to point something out in the context of tiny little children who are separated from their parents. I understand that was your personal response, that it was not as troubling for you as the older children, but for the little ones, depending upon the length of time they're separated and what happens to them, that separation can have lifelong damage. Mm-hmm. So I've read, so I've heard, that the brain is really plastic when children are tiny. And if a child is traumatized and suffers loss, unexplained loss, it can stay with them for the rest of their lives and have effects on trust and the capacity to attach and so on. So what the administration has done and others, but this administration in particular is quite cruel, has the potential to damage a child for its life, and I think it's important to point that out. But once again, thank you, Mari Ruth, for being there. You're incredible, and I think Immigration and Counseling Services does incredible work. So have a good day, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen, for
thank
your call
you, Karen.
This morning.
Yeah, and I do want to highlight that the little children that I see in court aren't necessarily separated from their parent. So children can be in deportation proceedings whether or not they are living with their parent.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I mean, my question around that is not so much my question goes to the heart of as a professional who represents people in these situations, to see even if it's happening not every day, but to see a child who obviously is too young to understand the ramifications of what is happening, and who may be barely verbal, who may be a toddler, you know, and to think about the absurdity
of
that situation.
You know, one of the training immigration judges who's responsible for training other immigration judges gave a deposition in which he claimed that he had taught 3 and 4 year olds immigration law.
Right.
Which, you know, I just have to laugh because clearly law school was a total waste of my time.
Obviously.
You know, but it becomes so absurd.
Right.
That,
yeah.
You know, it's laugh or cry.
That is kind of it. And as is so much of life these days in 2019 America. So we have only, you know, 4 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
what can people do that are concerned? You know, we always want to leave information in the hands of folks who are inspired by our conversations to say, you know, this is our world. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do to take it back? Mm-hmm. How are we going to help this situation? It is really a horrible situation on so many levels. Mm-hmm. There's the racism, there's classism, there's xenophobia, mm-hmm. and there's the dehumanization of people, the ripping apart of communities, the tearing apart of families. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the issues with the inhumane detention centers being ran for profit, forced labor, etc. All of these things. How can people help?
Well, so there's a number of things people can do. Of course, donating money is always very, very helpful. So if you're able to do that, please do. Being involved in local, so immigration is, mostly seen as a national issue, but there's actually a lot of local decisions that make huge impacts. If you are in one of the counties that that's Sherman, Gillum, Hood River, and Wasco counties that are part of the NORCOR facility, you can ask that they stop having ICE detainees in the facility. If you live in Yakima, you can ask your local jail to stop. That's a local decision that's made. A big thing is we're going to be seeing a push for driver's licenses for people in Oregon, going back to what we had before. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge, huge deal because that's a very terrifying and common way that people end up in immigration hands.
Yeah.
And it's also a way to make people criminals, right? You want to classify people as criminals? Well, you just criminalize what they do.
Can you break that down a little bit?
Yeah, so you take away people's ability to have a driver's license, mm-hmm. but you don't provide, you know, public transportation. I live in a rural county. There, you know, mm-hmm. you don't provide public transportation. You don't provide alternatives to driving. And so you have people who don't have any way to get a license and don't have any way to get around. And what they do is they drive without a license, and then they can be arrested for that.
Yeah.
And then you can say, well, look, they got arrested because they were committing a crime. When if you just allowed them to have a license, in fact, they wouldn't be committing a crime at all. So we're going to be seeing a push for driver's licenses in the state of Oregon. So if you live in Oregon, call your state rep, your state senator, and tell them you want a driver's license bill. We're hoping that it's going to go through the legislature next year. So please get to work on that. And then you can advocate on a local level for funding for immigration defense. So the city of Portland has put some money forward, but that expires in May. Ask them to re-up. The Multnomah County, ask them. They've put some money forward, but ask them to make it permanent. And we're looking at getting the state of Oregon to actually put some money towards immigrant defense in court to because most people don't have access to attorneys. So advocate for that. And then, of course, finally, at the national level, call your senators, call your representatives, and tell them that you don't want funding for prisons, for walls, that you want funding for welcoming, mm-hmm. right? How do we integrate people into our society, and how do we help support the countries that they're from? On a personal level, you can also join some of the groups, like join CAUSA Oregon, join Emerge here locally, join PIRC, P-I-R-C, to get updates on things that are going on. You can show up for vigils and protests, and you can also be an accompanier, meaning come to court with people, go to ICE check-ins with people, and help show ICE that they have community support. So those are all things that you can do to really stand with your immigrant community members and friends.
And then there are the two street sort of activist community organizing groups, which would be Occupy ICE and Icebreakers as well. You can check them out and find information about them online. I'm going to say social media is probably the place to find information about them. We are out of time. Mari Ruth, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Ani.
Next week, we will be talking about class and classism with Joe Clement from the Old Mole Variety Hour as we move on and try to make this world a better place for us all. Thanks, Ray.
When every second, every day, when every action, every
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on One Land, Many Voices, they will air the remarks delivered at the Realities of Jerusalem Today conference.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff to Black History on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information.